Welcome to the inaugural show zero of the Babylon podcast. My name is Summer Brooks.
I'm going to put that on and go into the spot factory and get to work.
My dog and I are being attacked by a duck.
I think I'm kidding, but I'm not.
When you're hungry, you're hungry.
The Virgin sits on a crate opening and closing his pipe.
Steph has a mind of its own tonight.
I didn't get any entries at all.
Telepaths against mundanes is no contest.
I like Day of the Dead.
I did too.
Hey guys, it's Gary. I'm listening to episode 1.
And God help us all, this is Joe Truman.
Production of the malt liquor beverage Zima.
Nice and close, and I looked at him and I go, do you want?
Hey there. Okay, actually, let me call you back in a minute. Bye.
Stella, I knew it was a bad idea to record. I knew it was.
And welcome back to another Babylon podcast. I'm Summer Brooks.
I am Tim Callender.
And that's all we have here. Summertime.
Yeah, we've stripped it down. Stripped it down lean and mean.
Not intentionally. Everybody else went out on summer vacation.
And it's not even summer yet. What is up with that?
Sure it is. It's after Memorial Day. It's officially summer. The 100 days of me.
I thought every day was about you, Summer.
I thought it was. I could be wrong. Nah, I'm not conceited at all. I'm just having fun. I'm happy. I have no idea why I'm happy. This is just fun. Actually, I know. I have two reasons why I'm happy.
Okay.
One, there was Amazon was having a sale today, which is
yes.
It's on June 2nd. All 5 seasons of Babylon 5 for $100. And I'm
so
like, done that a couple of years ago when we could have encouraged everybody to buy the DVDs to watch along with us?
Well, you know, look at it this way, though. This is the opportunity for people to get that loaner copy
So
that they can hand those out to family and friends and get them roped in without having to lose track of your precious original set.
And here's my other plan. We should encourage a new grassroots B5 viewing party effort to go on. That we just got done season 5. We could be overdue for a re-geeking.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that. Well, I think we're seeing some emails here that have mentioned similar things. You know what? It's interesting that you bring that up, though, about getting people interested again. Recently, the Orange County Screenwriters Association held an event at which J. Michael Straczynski was a featured speaker. And one of the things that was brought up that Joe himself addressed is that with 2013 coming up, which is the 20th anniversary of B5, it would be a good time to do a movie, and he has a story in mind, and apparently Warner Brothers is willing to put the money out to do a feature film.
Whoa.
They asked him how much... I'm reading a little bit. These are some postings that Gary sent links to on the JMS News Group, and Astro Boy posted up a little bit of this and said that... Joe has a story in mind, and apparently WB is willing to put the money out to do a feature film. But as he did say, he would have to have a script ready by 2011, shoot in 2012 for a 2013 release, so he is already behind schedule. And then Jan Schroeder made a post to kind of confirm that, says that JMS has told WB that he's got a $100 million budget in mind for the film, and they've told him to let them know when he's ready to discuss specifics.
Holy shit. Nikes.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you know how things go in Hollywood. Apparently, the other part of it, he's done another draft of the Lensman script, but we'll deal with that later. you know, I'll believe it once I've got my keister in the seat and the opening credits are running. But having said that...
No, you know what?
I
would have to respectfully request that we be allowed to see a shooting script. Once they start production, you know, I will sign an NDA. Just send me a copy.
Yeah, right, exactly. Exactly. I would be happy to tell everybody, nanny, nanny, guess what I have and I can't talk about.
I can't tell you anything about it, but oh my God, I can't wait to see this on screen.
Right, right. So, you know, I mean, as it goes, one of the other posts later on has commented about it, the film he's writing and is slated to direct called Flickering Light, which is a quote-unquote indie film. It's got a $25 million budget, and the comment was made that it's easier to get $100 million than it is to get $25 million.
Really?
So that also, yeah, so that also kind of lends credence to the fact that maybe something might, you know, at a glacial pace get started with a B5 film, so.
Okay. I have
to wonder how much the success of Star Trek might play into this as well.
I think it's more the lore of the anniversary, because everybody's going in for the ooh it's an anniversary. That I would have to believe it's more the anniversary angle than it is the let's jump on Star Trek's coattails and stomp them into, you know, dirty screaming mess. That's my thought. Also, I think if they really are seriously pushing, we should rally to create a ship name that gets used in the movie.
You know, yeah, okay.
A little wink, wink, nod, nod to the podcast, to us. We're going to have to work on a good name.
The EAS Summer Brooks.
There you go.
That's subtle. Or the EAS Willarth. Yeah, there we go. That.
The EAS Brookender. There you go. The Brookender.
Yeah. I like that.
That'll work. That'll work. Oh, yeah. We could geek on that long, too. I have another little tidbit of news here.
Yep.
Everybody may or may not remember Star Stuff, Julia, in Germany. Mm-hmm. She sent us a gift. And it's a very cool gift. FedCon is apparently the biggest sci-fi convention in Central Europe, in Germany.
Okay.
And a B5 regular was the master of ceremonies, Mr. Ed Wasser.
Ooh.
So she got us an 8x10 of Ed as Mr. Morden, and it's signed, Babylon Podcast, Summer and Tim, many thanks, Ed Wasser. And he's got a little smiley face under there. And I'm like, oh my God, this is so cool.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I got a Mr. Morden pick. And after how we geeked on Mr. Morden in the Babylon 5 Beefcake episode, that's just hilarious, because he's got that grin on his face. Like, come on, we're going. And at the after hour spots right now. Uh-huh. So this is cool. I'll have to scan you a pic of this, but this is way cool. Yeah. Thanks. Thanks, Julia.
Yeah, sweet. We'll scan it and get that posted up.
Oh yeah.
Share the love. Oh, that's great. Well, that's good to know that Ed is getting out and about as well. Not that he had no reason to, but you know, it's just kinda neat to, you know, even after all these years, that he's making appearances. That's great.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Cool. Grandpa Ed.
What do you want?
All right. Well, I tell you what I want. Ooh. I want to take a break and then come back and do some deep geeking. What do you say?
That works for me.
All right.
So, you're still hanging on to that tiny thread of denial, trying to convince yourself that sci-fi has nothing whatsoever to do with your life. Well, you better think again, Sparky. That tiny cell phone has no basis in Starfleet communicators. Those hands-free earpieces now used by virtually everybody didn't come down from the ear of Lieutenant Uhura. And that cute little Rumba vacuum cleaner that you use far too infrequently wasn't hijacked off an Imperial Star Cruiser. Nah, not a chance. Because if it were true, then you would be forced to turn on that Flash Gordon-inspired box on your desk called a computer and listen to SliceOfSciFi.com, the podcast and XM satellite radio show that will turn your sci-fi into reality.
Digging down to the minutest arcani of the B5 universe, this is Deep Geeking.
We got a new intro from Ed.
That's great. And appropriately. Well, Edmund in Greenville, obviously.
I know, but I hadn't heard it before.
That's I hadn't either. Yeah. Thank you, Edmund. Boy, we got a nice presents from Julia. We got a nice presents from Edmund.
Oh, man, that's awesome.
You like us. You really like us.
River of Souls.
River of Souls. You know what? Let me say just a general comment about it. Mm-hmm. This is one that when it first aired, I was kind of meh about. But the more I've watched it, it has really grown on me. And it's not a matter of like lowered expectations or comparing to the other ones. I really genuinely like this movie.
Mm-hmm. It's one thing changed for me since the last time I watched it a couple of years ago. One, it was realizing that, oh my God, that's Ian McShane swearing to his on the station.
Yep.
Oh, so that just re-solidifies Babylon 5 as a Western right there.
Yeah.
but I forgot how there's the first part of it, the first, I'm going to say 30 minutes, 25, 30 minutes is really, really slow.
Yeah.
And then when the action starts, it's, you can't be pulled away.
Right. Right.
And I don't remember the first time watching it feeling like, and like at first I thought I was bored. And it wasn't that I was bored. I realized that I was waiting to get to the action. I was anticipating the action, and I was saying, come on, move it along. We're get to the good stuff. And I don't remember feeling like that before. And I'm still trying to put my finger on what shifted.
Well, I think the one thing that I noticed watching it here today, to your point about the, I will say, deliberate pace, because, like I said, I've really come to enjoy it. The first easily 10 minutes of that movie, there's not a B5 regular in sight.
Nope.
And if you don't know that you're watching Babylon 5, you have no idea you're watching Babylon 5. So I think that might be part of that impatience. Because the other thing that I really enjoyed this time around, and one of the reasons that the film is growing on me, is that when we do get the B5 regulars, when we get Lockley and Corwin and Zach and Garibaldi, they are so lively and so fully realized that they are just a joy to watch them go through their paces.
I'm going to say it was fun seeing Garibaldi being... He's still got a little bit of his old mischievousness, but he's also being, you know, settling into being the new boss, the guy who we see later in Sleeping in Light. And we get to see a much looser, I'm going to say more relaxed Lockley, and a more assertive Corwin.
It's funny you should say that, because one of the things that strikes me about Corwin in this one is we see much more of his character.
Mm-hmm.
But he is such a dork. I mean,
like,
he...
apparent before?
You know, I mean, and I mean that with all the love in my heart. When he gifts that that affirmation bad to Lockley, he's like, he's almost like he's got a... I don't want to say it's a... he's not sucking up, because it's not that kind of a toady thing. But you can really tell that he's like wants to make a good impression or something. I don't know. It's a funny thing. And he's like, he's so eager to please, and he's so eager to give of himself and say, "Captain, this has really helped me. You're going to love it." And it's this thing. I mean, it's like, you've got to be kidding me. This, you're serious? And his expression when he's hitting himself with it, I mean, it's just like, what a dork.
Oh, it's someone who saw something that truly appealed to him. Have we ever seen late night infomercials on ISN? Because that's where that smells like it came
from. Yeah, absolutely. You're right. It had to have. As seen on ISN.
Yeah. So he's got like the 3 a.m. infomercial going on. And he's like, hey, I could really, that looks like it might work. And it, you could tell from the beaming in his face that something transformed about him. And he got a little boost of self-esteem from using that. And he's like, yeah. This helped me with tension. This helped me with self-esteem issues. I think this could, you know, help Captain Lockley too. And yeah, it's not, he's trying to ingratiate himself in a bad way. He honestly, he respects her. He cares about her well-being. And he thinks that, you know, hey, this worked for me. Maybe this will work for her too. And you can see her staring at it going, you know, when she starts banging the desk with it, she's like, okay, I can do this. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, so sincere. That's what's so wonderful about it.
Right. And the assertiveness comes in when later on when he's trying to get to med lab when she's been hurt.
Yeah.
You see, you know, he's instantly on the ball. So yeah, we get to see a full range of Corwin's character. And yes, I'm still trying to get a hold of Joshua Cox to see if he'll talk to us.
Oh, very good. I would love to. Because I also love the opening sequence where they're in the Zocalo. I say the opening sequence of the station. And she's talking about, Lockley's talking about the Polly effect and how everything's quiet because there's no Sheridan, no Garibaldi. And he's like, yeah, about that. Captain. Oh, yeah, Captain. I mean, it's almost an obvious joke, but it's still pretty funny. As soon as he says, well, Mr. Garibaldi just arrived, and then a fist fight breaks out.
And what's hilarious is I have to believe that JMS himself believes that there's a lot of that going on in his life, because that's repeated in Jeremiah with the whole strange attractors thing. It didn't click for me until I saw it. I'm like, that's either forces we have no control over at work, or somewhere in some parallel universe watching down over us is the imp of the perverse, and he's just going, yeah, I'm going to play with this person.
Right. And I really like the interaction between Lockley and Garibaldi in this this movie. A little bit of the adversarial quality is there, but also, I mean, when he shows up at her office and tells her that, she finds out that Garibaldi is scheduled to meet his meet Bryson there. And she's just like, oh, you know, how could you do that? But then there's that moment where she stops and looks at him and asks, are you still sober?
Yeah. That's the one that got me. The part where he's like, you know, you're still keeping with it? And he's like, yeah. And you can tell they're going from that moment of when they're, you know, they're needling each other. It's like, oh, yeah, I didn't think you'd mind me using your office. Come on. It's me.
Yeah.
To the moment of, how you doing? You know, that's you know, what, four sentences says more about their characters than, you know, any info dump and ever.
Right. And where they've been and where they are now. Absolutely. Yeah. And it was just, it was well performed. You know, like I said, this one really, it's almost a shame that this was the swan song for Elizabeth Lockley. I mean, I know she gets some screen time in Crusade, but Tracy Scoggins really owned the character in this one, and whether or not it's because JMS finally figured out what he wanted to do with the character or what, I don't know, but there's all throughout, it's peppered with these moments of where she's definitely in command and she's definitely making decisions, like when the vengeful souls are doing their thing, and she's like putting the pieces together, but as basically taking command prerogative and saying, I'm only telling you what you need to know at this moment, you hop to it. But by the same token, the way she deals with the Soul Hunter, it is so compassionate that I mean this in all sincerity and in all, you know, not to be misogynist, but it's the kind of thing that a female character would bring to that kind of situation. I mean, I think if Sheridan was there, he would have understanding, but I don't know that he would have that level of compassion for the situation.
Empathy.
That's right. That's exactly the good word. That's exactly it. You know, what she shows, what she shows to the Soul Hunter, and it takes him aback. I mean, he comes in expecting to be reviled, and everybody's ready. I mean, Garibaldi is about ready to toss him out the airlock. And she takes him at face value and deals with him in the moment. And I think that is really one of the things that I think is one of the most beautiful things about this film.
Interesting. You know, I could see, I'm trying to think, how would Sheridan, you know, before Zaha Doom and after Zaha Doom deal with the Soul Hunter? And there's a spiritual curiosity that you see she gets when they're talking, and you know, when the four of them, it's like it's her, Zach,
Garibaldi
are talking to the Soul Hunter. They're, you know, and she's actually more curious about what it is he does and not so much judgmental.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
I love that scene too, where Zach confronts the Soul Hunter, you know, if you kept him from heaven, and Garibaldi, the way he looks at him, is like, what? So I believe in heaven. that was another one of those pitch perfect character moments. Again, you know what Zach is about. It's real pragmatic, and it doesn't feel out of character for him to say that.
Right.
But I just love the way he said it. What? So I believe what?
So what do you think about the premise for why the souls were captured? I believe that was just literally what, did you watch the introduction?
I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't watch that. Yeah.
So there's an introduction to the movie in the movies collection where they talk to Copeland, JMS, Janet Greek, Tracy Scoggins, and you know, she's talking about how cool it was to work with Martin Sheen. And Copeland was saying that the reason this movie, the main reason this movie came about is because everybody wanted to know more about the Soul Hunters. Mm. And I got that impression that JMS wanted to write a story. It's like, well, we've explored how, you know, what happens when the humans make mistakes is, you know, when they first encounter the Minbari. We see what happens when the Vorlons make mistakes. Well, they manipulated telepaths and that backfired across everything. What happens when you have a race that's powerful, that's so assured in its infallibility, what happens when you put a mistake right in front of them and say, hey, you did make a mistake? And I think that was an opportunity to explore that with the Soul Hunters, because what happens, you know? Hey, yeah. What would have happened if the Soul Hunters had scooped up the Vorlons when they evolved into energy beings? Dude!
Right. I think that the concept of the evolving race to energy beings, while it works in the B5 universe, you know, there's precedent for that, obviously. I think that's a bit of a science fiction cliche, generally speaking, but I can deal with it because, again, I think the thrust, for me, the thrust of the story was less about the Soul Hunter's fatal error or grievous error and more about the relationship between Lockley and that Soul Hunter. that she shows him something that no one has ever showed any of his order. And he responds to that in an honest fashion. And so, I mean, part of it is it gets real wordy. I think there's about three separate bits of dialogue where Martin Sheen talks about how their order was infallible, and then, you know, after Lockley has pointed out, well, I was there, they took me into the globe, and they told me that they were about to evolve and not dying. There's about three separate bits where he kind of goes on about, you know, how could we be wrong, but we were wrong, and our arrogance, and it just is like, okay, you're kind of driving the point home. You know, you could, I get it. Having said that, I really loved Martin Sheen's performance.
Mm-hmm.
And when he makes the decision to basically act as a sacrifice, I felt that that was really believable. That to me, again, it was much more about they didn't make as much of that whole grab the species that was evolving into pure energy beings as they could have. It was a springboard, and so I didn't mind that as much.
Yeah, it wasn't about that race. Where were they? They were from the planet Ralga. I don't think they actually said the name of the race, but I think it was more about opening a door for the soul hunters, because, you know, as you've said, they believe in their infallibility in collecting souls, and this is, you have one soul hunter who is touched by the fact that one being from a different race saved his life, most likely.
Mm-hmm.
And that opens him up to listening, to considering, seriously considering the possibility that they did make a mistake. Because otherwise, if that hadn't happened, he never would have listened.
Right.
And the fact that that connection, that she saved his life, led him to listen to her and consider the possibility, that makes him a doorway. As he said at the end, that makes him a doorway for the rest of his people, the other soul hunters, to maybe understand that they did make a mistake and they actually have the technology to work on a solution, to rectify it. And I think it's a parallel evolution here. They prevented the evolution of a race, and 10,000 years later, that becomes a turning point for them to evolve into, I don't know, something a little bit more cautious, compassionate, less arrogant. I don't know how you want to say it, but that's how I see it.
Right. No, and I agree. I think that that's one of the beauties of it, is that it takes what could potentially be a very idea-based story and brings it down to a very personal level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the emotional interactions between the characters, I thought, was good. Even the humorous bits. The I don't know what about it made it so funny, but Zach going, "Come on, we've survived wars, we've survived the shadows, we're going to give it to a bunch of lawyers."
Yes. Before we get into the B plot, because I have some questions about that for you. One of the things I want to touch on with Martin Sheen's performance, I liked how he carried off a being who was simultaneously ancient with that wisdom of all those years of experience, and yet also had a naivety about him.
Mm-hmm.
And that was especially evident after Lockley basically, saved his life and began treating him as an individual and not as an idea, you know. Not lumping him in with all the soul hunters and just, you know, dealing with him as an individual, as an entity. There were great gestures. I loved his eyes. There was just something he was doing with his eyes that was very alien and yet very expressive as well.
Yeah, because I was always he pulled off the childlike side of it very well. He has a moment where he's being a little bit condescending, sort of like, "Oh, but you don't understand." But there's like a childlike quality to it.
Yeah.
You know how when your toddler goes, oh, Mom, you don't understand.
Like, or your teenager. Yeah. I know. Those are
change. I do have one other thing. In that intro to the movie, apparently, right? Sheen was initially approached to play Ian McShane's part, Bryson, the
really?
Archaeologist. Yeah. And he came back and said, no, I want to play the Soul Hunter. And they said, are you sure? It's a lot of makeup. He says, no, this is what I want to do. So, yeah. So he was initially going to be Bryson, and he turned out to be the Soul Hunter, which I think is better, because Bryson pretty much disappears for most of that action part.
Yes, right. He is the path into the plot and the story. But after that, he's basically just kind of sitting around and, at Torrance. Yeah.
And that would have been a huge waste of Martin Sheen, as far as I'm concerned. So that was good call on him.
Yeah, I agree. Now, you know what? Now, let me ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
What is it with people trying to find the secret of immortality? And I'm not talking about just B5. I'm talking about science fiction and fiction in general. Why is everybody on about immortality? Do you really have that much to do?
What year did Cortez land in Florida?
Yeah, I know, right, exactly.
So this isn't fiction here. This goes back to the history of humanity. You know, hey, we live short lives. And literally, our lifespan, the lifespan of this period in history, what... Human civilization, current human civilization is what, 10,000 years old? Maybe?
Sure. Yeah.
All right. That literally is the beginning of a fart in a star, okay?
Yeah, right.
That's nothing. We, not even a blink. All right. So how do you gain more experience without living longer? How do you gain more wisdom without having a longer lifespan with which to acquire the knowledge, the experience to actually...
Here's an interesting point in that, because it's one of the things that I was thinking about watching at this time, and today watching it, I was really much more aware of the subtext that I think Straczynski was trying to get across. And I think one of those is that immortality is not all it's cracked up to be. I think if you look at all the long-lived races, with the exception of Lorien, okay, they fall into hubris like nobody's business. Or they go mad.
Well, I mean, there's between immortality and, yeah, I'm sure immortality could get old after a while. But you know what? I wouldn't mind living for 500 years. That'd be kind of cool.
I mean, yeah, I'll give you that. And I understand that. I guess really what I'm trying to say is all the stories about looking for immortality are cautionary tales. Even all the way back to Cortez, who died looking for the thing.
I was corrected by the chat room. Cortez was Mexico. Ponce de Leon was...
Ponce de Leon. Okay, yes. Thank you. Right.
Yeah,
thank you, chat room.
But still.
We love you. But the point is, you know, even in River of Souls, what happens to Bryson is he basically loses his marbles.
Only temporarily.
Or, well, I don't know. I mean, as Garibaldi says in the end, he's going to keep looking whether or not he's funded by... Eggers Industries or not.
But that's another one of those, hey, he's a true seeker. You know, he's looking for something, and he's going to keep looking until he can't look anymore. I mean, how many people have searched for the Grail because, hey, maybe it gives you eternal life too. Everyone wants more life. And I don't know whether if it's a longer life or eternal life. What do you... It's not just a science fiction thing, I guess, is what I'm saying. We know there's more out there, and we want to live long enough to see more of it, damn it.
Sure. It's, I mean, it is part of the human condition. I agree with you there. I agree with you. But every time I think of all these stories where somebody says, I'm closing in the secret of immortality, it's like, oh, meep, 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 meep.
Oh,
red
so
alert, it's, red alert.
It's a science fiction trope that you believe has been overdone.
Maybe that's a better way to put it. Sure. Yes. Yes.
Here's the thing. I don't think that in River of Souls, it's about the immortality. The search for a way to acquire immortality is just the underlying push that leads to this spiritual quandary. It's not the end goal of the movie to find a way to make everybody live forever.
Right, I agree, and I understand that, and I think one of the messages that is here in this story is that long life does not necessarily equate to wisdom. I mean, that's the lesson being taught to the soul hunters. You know, in their arrogance of thinking they're doing the right, they never, you know, as the soul hunter says toward the end as they're closing in on Bryson, he says, well, you know, if there was a mistake, the order would investigate it, but the order doesn't think there was a mistake made, so no investigation was performed.
Okay. All right. Okay. So maybe not everybody who's searching for longer life just in the spiritual or the wisdom. Maybe there's a few people out there who just want to party for another extra 50 years. I don't know.
That's fine. No, I'm just saying in terms of the specifically the B5 universe, that's kind of the underlying message. You look at the Vorlons and their level of hubris. You know, even in Third Space, you know, one mistake amongst all those many. You know, the Shadows, the same deal. They had their own level of arrogance. They thought they were doing the right thing by kicking over the anthill. That's how things progress. So they were justified in what they were doing. You know, if anything, the first ones got the hell out of the galaxy because they were just tired of it all. Yeah, we've lived this long. We've done all this. Eh. Longevity, long shmevity. We're going out to the rim, play some golf.
Nah. There's no golf out there, dude. Come on. Be real.
Ninth planet in the right, yeah, shuffle board, yeah. So, anyways, but I did like the interplay between Garibaldi and Bryson at the beginning when they're meeting, and Bryson is trying to negotiate, and you could tell he thinks Garibaldi's just another corporate guy. Mm-hmm. I need a little more time, a little more fun, and Garibaldi looks and goes, nope, you've got till tomorrow morning. You know, and you could tell that was not what he expected.
Well, no, you could tell Garibaldi had a look in his eye. He was interested. You know, he's like, yeah, there's a profit angle here and he was willing to listen. But when he says, I don't quite have it yet, and he goes, my scam button just went up.
Right, yeah, yeah.
But you could, he had him for a minute. For a minute, yeah. He had him. If he could have said, it's like, well, I have something, but I'm not sure what it is yet, and yeah. I don't want to show you until I'm sure. You know, if he had couched it in terms that weren't quite so
vague,
converted zealot.
Yeah, right. There you go.
Yeah, we're talking zealot here. He was in zealot territory. It's like, I would explain it to you, but I know you won't understand, but I want to make sure I can explain it to you in words your tiny brain can understand, so you'll give me more.
Right. Now, speaking of tiny brains, mm-hmm. What is your take on the hollow brothel subplot?
It was there to give Zach something to do at the beginning.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah.
Here's
was a plot device for the angry souls. It was that part felt shoehorned in there. And then when the angry souls took it over, you know, took over the bodies to, quote, distract everybody, that's, yeah, that didn't.
Yeah, see, and here's the thing now, you know, given.
As the other elements, yeah.
Yeah, given that I'm not a writer, when I feel like something's gratuitous, I try, in my mind anyways, to retell the story to see if there's another way to work it. And I can't quite find the way to rework it. Because I really think, as much humor as was derived from the situation, putting Lockley in the bustier was 99.9% gratuitous. Because if for nothing else, you know, as that apparition walks off, she morphs into the Earth Force uniform.
Because it's looking at her. It changes in it.
Okay, good point.
She said it herself. It chose a form that I would pay attention to. If it had picked any of the other hollow models in there, she wouldn't have cared. They wouldn't have been inclined to follow the group of them to figure out what they were up to. So I'm okay with that. And I wish you had seen the intro, because she talks about it. She's like, yeah, that was my hollow hoe. She talks about the hollow hoe, and it was hilarious.
I'll have to go back and watch it then. Yeah. I like the little bit where she appears, they're standing there, and there's Zach and Ron Jeremy, for all intents and purposes, and Garibaldi, and Zach's getting incensed, and there's Garibaldi.
He's considering it. You could tell he's playing.
What are you doing? Playing. Stop looking. What? You want to actually blind myself?
He's playing a tape in his mind with that look on his face. And when the brothel owner says, actually, she's more popular with the ladies, and you see both of them look at each other, and they go, not going there.
Yeah, right. I know. Exactly. And that bit in the lift between Garibaldi and Lockley was also very funny, too.
Yes.
I hear it's really popular. Really? So I've heard. It's like, okay. All right.
So, yeah, there was a method to the madness at the end. What else would you use that kind of holographic technology for the space station? Come on.
This is
the envelope of technology, all right?
Porn? Sex drives, it drives the envelope of technology all the way. So that's why, in that sense, even with the gratuitous nature of it, there was that part of me that's like going, well, you know, it kind of makes sense. You know, it kind of does, and it kind of makes sense that it would be the sleazy guy down there who's working the angles.
It was introduced a little clumsily, but the effect, the reason for it at the end worked. I'm okay with that.
Right.
You know, the first time I'm watching, I'm going, what? Really?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, so it was okay. But, you know, I liked how Zach dealt with it. I liked the sleazy owner who's, you know, I my First Amendment rights and all that stuff. It's like, you know, I am not a social conservative. But, you know, people, I think, misuse and misrepresent the concept of free speech.
I dare somebody to show me where in the First Amendment or in the First Amendment of the Earth Alliance Constitution where it says, you have the freedom of porn. I dare ya.
it's applicable to the government. That's what people forget. You know, it's your ability to protest and say things about the government without fear of reprisal. Anyway, right. That's neither here nor there. That has nothing to do with setting up a hollow brothel in Brown Sector.
Exactly. You know, yes. that's called your lawyer saw a loophole and told you to run through it.
Exactly. And as much as it was a caricature, I like the lawyer bit. I mean, I thought that was exactly the whole deal. I mean, it's kind of a stock character that JMS trots out now and again. You know, and the final solution to it was a similar stock thing that Joe uses, but I didn't mind it because it was a nice wrap up. It was, you know, it was one of those things. It's like Lockley in essence has these huge things, and what does she really have to deal with? This little gnat that keeps showing up. You know, soul hunters, 10,000-year-old souls looking for vengeance. Oh, and by the way, we're suing. What?
I do like that her solution to the problem was a grenade. That's awesome.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And the funny part is like the two guys are holding the one guy back, and he's, you know, she's rifling through different pockets, and like the first guy, and he's like looking at her like, what the, and he's like, oh, here it is. He's like, yeah. Garibaldi, is that a grenade?
Yeah. Yeah. And I like the bit when they're down there in Brown Sector where Garibaldi and Zach are making their investigation. They come across the body, and here comes the brothel owner, and he's all indignant, and all of a sudden he just kind of says, is that guy dead?
Yep.
That was nice. That was like his first recognition that maybe he's in a little deeper than...
Yeah, it's more than just about him right now.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. I was going to say, there's one other sour note in there, that, or just something that was a little off-key, and I can't remember it, so I guess it's not really that dreadfully important, or I'll remember it tonight, sit up in a cold sweat. I mean, overall, I thought, I know what it was. This was the one that really kind of, it was like, eh? Where Lockley, she takes the energy blast after she pushes the Soul Hunter out of the way. She goes into the sphere, sees the Ralga, and sees Stephen Franklin. And, of course, he's actually one of the souls in there talking to her about the situation. And there's two things in there that really just kind of, I kind of go, eh? One is the alien says the soul sees what the soul wants to see. So did she want to see Stephen Franklin with a bad Jamaican accent?
Well, it was the mind sees what it needs to see. And she,
but it hears whatever else we're going to give it. Is that, right. I mean, is that the,
yeah,
no, that doesn't make any sense.
It basically, it's like, do you remember in Contact where she saw her father?
Yes.
Because her brain couldn't process whatever else she was seeing.
Sure.
That's what I liken it to.
Right, but her father was not talking like a surfer dude.
Right, but the whole point of that was to have, if she was really talking to Franklin, Franklin wouldn't be able to give us that information. So he's talking in a different accent so that we know we're not talking to Franklin. That's my take.
He just said, I'm not Franklin, you're seeing this because this is what you want to see. What else do you need?
We have people who don't pay attention. Come on, man.
Well, that's their own damn fault. The other bit that made me go, huh?
They could have modulated his voice, you know, because we could have, I don't know, that's my thing. But
yeah, I
maybe
mean,
that
he could have had a different cadence to his speech, but a whole other accent. It was just for me, it was very jarring and unnecessary. The other bit in that scene that made me go, is when she gets down, it first arrives in the sphere, and she says, well, you know, my heart stopped, and she says, I've been down here for longer than a second. And he goes, well, you know, time has no meaning here. And then she's standing there and goes, oh, we don't have a whole lot of time, so let me tell you a quick little thing. It's like, wait a minute, you just said that time has no meaning here.
No, that's not what he said.
Yeah, that's what he said.
Well, time spent in there didn't have meaning, but they started to revive her, so there was a time limit. It's not like they weren't going to revive her. As soon as they started to shock her heart and bring her back, her time there was up. They couldn't hold on to her because her body, her soul was being called back to her body. So that part, I don't have a problem with that part.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Maybe.
All right. Gary's just called in four times about that already.
I mean, even with those little missteps, I of all the TNT made for TV movies, and I'm not counting Call to Arms in this because that's its own creature.
Mm-hmm.
This one's my favorite. I mean, I genuinely like it. I really like watching it. I get engaged in it, and I think it's got great performances, great characters. And so, yeah.
And
how about you, Summer? You got any?
No, I have nothing else. I really, really wish that I had the opportunity to read the novelization of this. The novelization of it was written by a friend of mine, and I really, really, really wish I had the opportunity to read it. That's all.
We'll have to have your friend on and get the true story.
He's not going to. I've been asking for years. I've been asking her for years. She's like, nope, can't talk about it. Just not going to happen. I'm like, okay. Got a little hint of from JMS when we talked to him, but we're not going to see it.
Well, you know, the truth is a three-edged sword.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've just been informed that Gary has called in 5 times already, so we're gonna take a break really quick, answer a few questions, and call it a break for a while.
All right.
Have you ever wanted to set up your own website? How about post your insights, ideas, or creative works on the web for others to contemplate, comment, or enjoy? Sound intriguing? If so, then WordPress is the software for you. It's so easy to get started and create content. And best of all, it's free. Now, to help you get going, check out the book, Teach Yourself WordPress in 10 Minutes, and the companion podcast, Teach Yourself WordPress in 10 Minutes, in 10 Minutes, hosted by authors Chuck Tomasi and Craig Stepp. Whether you're brand new to WordPress or have been using it for years, you're sure to learn something from Chuck and Craig. In each 10-minute episode, the companion podcast covers tips, insights, latest developments, and useful WordPress information that just wouldn't fit in the book. Be more effective with WordPress.com and WordPress.org by listening to the podcast, Teach Yourself WordPress in 10 Minutes. In 10 minutes. Find it at ChuckChat.com or search for Teach Yourself WordPress in iTunes.
So we have emails.
Yeah, we got some emails. Let's try to get some of these knocked out of here. A fair number of these, I guess about 3 or 4 of these, are Day of the Dead things, but I don't think we're necessarily kicking the dead horse here. Some interesting takes on it. So the first one comes to us from Michael Johnston. He writes, "For a second, I thought Farpoint had attracted some product placement. I heard Tim refer to Adobe Barrier, and I thought that maybe this is coming after Flash. Re-listening, sadly, turned out to be Dopey Barrier. But for a split second, after hearing so much about Steve Jobs and his anti-Flash sentiment, I really thought I heard it." Well, you know, we would be happy to have Adobe as a sponsor on the Babcast.
Mm-hmm.
I use all the Creative Suite stuff, so there you go. All right, next one. This comes to us from George Moore. He writes, "Regarding the magic chalk, I look at it as a marker that an outside force, advanced tech or supernatural, can act on. Since it's TV, a visual medium, it had to be something visual. As for the pairings of the dead with the alive, I have several ideas. I would like to have seen some of the following pairings in no particular order. Sheridan with Anna, Sheridan with Morden, Delenn with Morden, Londo with Morden, Lanier with Valen, Franklin with Marcus, even though he's only mostly dead. Because, you know, if he was really dead, there'd only be one thing to do. Delenn with Valen, Delenn with Narune, Londo with Rifa, Garibaldi with Morden, Garibaldi with Talia." And George points out one of the comics shows someone who looks a lot like her preserved in the background panel. "Garibaldi with Edgars or Garibaldi with Sinclair. I think these pairings provide better dynamics and better character moments than what we saw on screen." Well, I would say that I think Garibaldi and Dodger was a good pairing.
Mm-hmm.
Out of these, I would like Sheridan with Anna would have been very interesting.
Hmm.
But I still stand by Veer and Morden. I think that would have been really...
Yeah, Veer and Morden makes more sense than Delenn and Morden. They really didn't have any...
There's no interaction. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's an interesting concept, Lanier with Valen, because Valen... I guess Valen had to die at some point, but he also is alive again at a later point in his life.
Yeah. I'm thinking, since it was so far after before when in time, it's possible. But I see him as being more in transit, since he's Sinclair than Valen than Sinclair than Valen. He's not going to be a position to be called from beyond, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's one of those limbo things. It reminds me of what Amy Pond said in Beast Below when they land on Starship UK. "I've been dead for 300 years. All right. Gary Henderson writes, mm-hmm. he says, you guys have discussed and discussed and discussed who Lanier should have seen instead of Morden, but something occurred to me while listening to the last few episodes that no one addressed. Who would Dr. Franklin have seen had he been in the Bracuri zone during the celebration? I have three answers, and I can't decide between them. One, Sean, the boy from Believers that he tried to save but ultimately couldn't. Two, the Markab doctor from Confessions and Lamentations. And three, Kaelin, the singer from Walkabout.
I think it would have been Kaelin.
Yeah, I think so too, given the nature of what those relationships are. But Sean, that's a really good suggestion.
It is.
You know, because it gets back to and given the kind of story arc that Franklin had, when you think about where he was in Believers, you know, that scene where Sinclair says to him, well, who made you God? And he says, they do. Every time they come in there, they look at me, you know, and so he thinks he's doing the right thing and comes up against beliefs greater than him. I don't think that one incident leads to the stim abuse, but it's a number of those things over time that gets him to the point where he's using the addiction to run away from facing up to his own mortality and his own inability to do things sometimes. So I think given where he comes through on the other side of that addiction story, to come back and confront that again, I think that would have been a really, really powerful story.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. This one. Yeah, you have any other comments?
Nope. That's...
Okay. Yep, Tim just talking to talk.
Yeah.
Not a problem. Okay, this one comes to Frank, to us from Frank. He writes, someone mentioned that the dead that visited were called. If so, that may explain why Morden visited Lanier. Lanier, even if on some subconscious level, was beginning to realize his love of Delenn was a betrayal, and the biggest traitor to intelligent life that Lanier knew of would have been Morden. The dead never said anything the living didn't already know. It just gave them closure to hear it. Lanier couldn't want closure on his love, and so refused to hear Morden's message. And just for the record, Summer's right, Tim's wrong. Purple.
See ya.
Huh. I'm out.
That's an interesting one. The people who came were the ones that the people most needed to hear from, who had a message that they most needed to hear. But Lanier wasn't ready to
hear that message.
Come to terms with that, yeah.
Right.
Interesting.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
No, that's a good point. That's a good point that Frank has. Okay. This comes to us from Kevin Segetti. Kevin, I'm sorry if I just butchered that. He says, I first heard of the Babylon podcast last July when you did the JMS interview. After listening to that interview, I started listening to the shows from the beginning. You poor soul. I just got up to the episode 95, Sick Transit Veer, where you asked for B5 while sick stories. I don't know if you remember that summer we were talking about how feeling ill and watching B5 or having encounters that way. He goes on to write, Kevin, my sick story isn't about B5, it's about your podcast. Yeah, that was my first thought, too. He writes, last... No, it's a happy ending, I promise. Last November, I got what must have been the swine flu. I was incapacitated for a couple of weeks, could only focus enough to watch TV for a few hours a day. So I spent the rest of the time listening to podcasts, mostly yours. I must have listened to 50 shows in those 2 weeks, and they made it bearable. You must have been dying. That's all I can say. Since then, I only manage about a show a week. Guess I need to get sick again if I'm actually going to catch up. So thanks for making my illness tolerable.
Wow. They like us. They really, really like us.
Kevin, you're welcome, I think. Wow, you must have been really sick. I mean, it's part of the joke is that we've denigrate our own show, but man, I don't know if I was that sick that I could sit down and listen to.
Does that mean we're just ear candy?
You know what? If it brings health and wellness to even one person in the universe, then Summer, I think we've succeeded.
We've done our job.
We have. Yep. So thanks for listening to the last episode of the Babylon Podcast.
we still have a ways to go yet. We haven't done Crusade.
I know, we haven't.
We're there. We're almost there. We're that close.
One last email here. This comes to us from Frank in Baltimore. I don't know if it's the same Frank as above, but here we go. Says, guys, love the podcast. Been listening since number one. Had to chime in on episode 195. Okay. And that was our deep geeking on Third Space.
Okay.
So Frank writes some points about the writing on the artifact. The obvious guess that we left out. This new space portal brought to you by Zima.
Nice.
And as far as a point about leaving a robot or something to guard the gate for when it's activated, they say, go here and guard this silly portal, brain the size of a small planet, and I sit here guarding this silly portal. I've been here a million years, not that you'd care. Did I mention I have a pain in the diodes all down my left side?
All right, obviously I'm missing something.
Marvin from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, there you go. So your foot closes. Keep up the good work. By the way, fave episode to date was Jerry Doyle with JMS running a close second. So.
All righty then.
There you go. And that's it for email for tonight.
Yay.
Yep.
So we're going to have, and Gary's already called in a sixth time already. Jesus Christ. Really? All right. Well, that'll do it, I believe, for this evening.
Yeah.
Once again, thank you for entrusting our Babylon 5 and Analysis and Geek to us. We are doing our best. I just lost my train of thought, and I'm trying to catch it back.
I kind of noticed that there was a.
I see the railroad tracks. I don't even see the train. Oh. Oh man, talk about jumping the track. Anyway, if you want to join us, the website is babylonpodcast.com. If you want to send in your own email, that's babylonpodcast@gmail.com. You can even record your own voicemail message and email it to that address, or argue amongst yourselves over at the forums, farpointforums.com. Look for the Babylon Podcast logo, or call in your own voicemail. Join in the fun that has become the Babylon Podcast Feedback-a-Palooza. The number to call is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
Dear, the Soul Hunters came for us all.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the gate.